We have a special treat, hour two and three tonight. My former co-host on Thursdays in the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show, Mark Levine, was very busy hanging out with the big people. You know, those politician types, as he was running for Congress in the great state of Virginia. Well, the people in his district obviously made their mistakes, as he did not come in first, which is what you need to win in that race. And unfortunately, he lost. But for us, we are glad to have him back, although not under these circumstances. I did want to be able to say, I have a congressman on speed dial and his cell phone number, and he's one of my dearest friends. But no, I don't get to do that. But I do get to say, he is Mr. Mark Levine. He is my partner in crime. This is the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show, which we used to have every second hour on Thursdays and sometimes third hours, and I've missed him so much, and we have so much to talk about. We're going to have him on for 2 hours. But because he's been hobnobbing with the bigwigs, he's like, yeah, I don't need to send topics in the order. I don't need to give my bio to the new guy who doesn't know me from Adam. So Mark, get introduce yourself. Give your bio, because well, I can't remember all the – I should know it by heart, but I don't.
Well, I think Mark Grimaldi's off today because I think it's his anniversary with Gina, right?
Yes, it is. Well, and we will also give out his we'll give out his ATM PIN code and other information about his personal life later.
Fair enough. Yes, this is Mark Levine, and I am back with my tail a little bit between my legs, back home.
No. Can I explain something to you? You should not have your tail between your legs. I think it's okay to say this now. You and I were the only two people who were out and about in the city of D.C. a few months ago in a nasty blizzard. We were having cocktails, my dirty martini, and you were having, what were you having, sweetie? I forgot.
I don't remember. It was Italian, I think. I'm not sure.
No. Your drink. I said I was having a dirty
martini. Oh, I don't remember.
Oh, you change it up, I guess, right? We ate at a nice place. It was like Bobby Flay's or one of those places, right?
And, yeah, something like that.
We had a good meal. We had, you know, a good time. Nice waiter who was happy to wait on us because we were the only people eating in the entire restaurant, because who the hell's out in a blizzard except for the people stuck in the city? And Mark was nice enough to drive in from Virginia not that he's that far. He's, you know, right over, you know, the bridge or, you know, down the causeway, so to speak. Mark looked at me and he said, I have some news I want to share with you. And I knew Mark wasn't going to say I'm pregnant, you know, or anything like that. But I knew it wouldn't be bad news because he had a twinkle in his eye and he was smiling. And he said to me, I'm going to run for Congress. And I was like, oh my God. And I got tingly, you know, and I got really, really tingly. And not in that way, because Mark's gay. So not in that way. But, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, I was just so proud of you. And I am so proud of you because how many people say, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to open a company. But you said it, you meant it, and you went full steam ahead. And you went from seriously out of nowhere to, you know, second place, and I think, you know, and you ended, what, third or fourth place? And that's incredible because you never ran for office before, correct?
I never ran for office before. I got 2,613 votes. I got 7%, which doesn't sound like much, but given that there were seven candidates in the race, it was a decent first time. It was a decent first time out. You know, I've learned the hard way that a lot of politicians, I guess I should look this up, but most of them do not succeed their first time out. Barack Obama's very first race was for Congress, like mine. He ran in a primary against Bobby Rush, Democrat from the South Side of Chicago, lost in a landslide, and then went to the state house in Illinois, and the rest is history. But, you know, it's very hard to win your first time out because name recognition means a lot. And polls were showing that I was ahead of people who knew who I was, but I was way behind the people who had never heard of me.
Well, now they've heard of you, and that's a good thing. But you know what? We're going to talk about a lot of different things, but we're going to be together 2 hours tonight, right? I get more time with you tonight?
Sure.
Awesome. Sure. So do you mind spending a little time talking to all these wonderful people that listen to us worldwide about the process as a candidate as opposed to, you and I are very heavily involved in politics and our jobs as talk show host. You were an attorney and worked for Barney Frank, and you know, you worked on various cases like, you know, Gore v. Bush, and you know, and not just as an attorney, you know, you live in, you know, you live in the Beltway, and you've been always very politically involved and co-hosting this program, but now as a candidate, I mean, did you get more excited about the process, a little bit disillusioned by the process? And I don't say that based on the outcome, which is that you didn't win, but like you said, really tough to be victorious the first time around. So share with people listening who might be entertaining running for something, even if it's that local, you know, council position.
Sure. You know, when you get involved in the race, and the reason I got involved in the race is because I know policy very well. As you said, I used to work in Congress. I worked for Barney Frank, who was one of the most competent members of Congress ever. He was not only very liberal, but he also got a lot of things done across the aisle with Republicans. And so I learned firsthand from one of the best exactly what it's like to serve in Congress. And then, of course, I've been on the radio for 10 years and TV. So I've dealt with every imaginable issue, at least federal or international issue, that's ever crossed my way, whether on, you know, Fox or MSNBC or talking with you, Leslie. So I ran because I knew policy very well, because I drafted legislation on everything from domestic violence to marriage equality to helping prevent child abuse, including all this, and that's the stuff outside of what I did for Barney Frank. So I knew policy. I knew how to be a member of Congress. I still know very easily how to be a member of Congress. And the irony is, running against a bunch of people who almost all of them had served in Virginia but had never worked in Washington, and so did not know how to be members of Congress. So I put on my policy hat, and I loved the debates. When we had the debates, the commentators said that I won all of them, that I would get an A when the other candidates would get, you know, B's and C's and occasionally an A minus. And so on policy, I was golden. But politics, unfortunately, is rarely about policy. I wish it were all about policy. I wish there were a debate every night. I wish all of the people who voted got to see us in the debates. But very few people attended the debates. And the really sad part about the race that is extremely disillusioning is that only about 8% of voters showed up for the primary. Eight. Not 18, not 80. Eight. Now, in a presidential race, you know, we're happy if we get 50%. Of course, that, I'm not happy with that either. But when it comes down to a primary, it's way, way less. And it was a really bad for people not to show up, because this particular district, given the way it was structured through gerrymandering from the Republicans who control the Virginia State House, they had gerrymandered the district, so they basically put all the Democrats together. And the area of Northern Virginia where I live is just outside of Washington, D.C., as Leslie says, and it's heavily, heavily liberal. So the primary was the election. I mean, the winner of the primary, Don Beyer, will certainly win in November, because this is a district that's 70-80% Democratic. So this was the vote that mattered, and the last person who held this seat served for 24 years. So clearly this was the race that mattered, and yet you find people, particularly young people, particularly new immigrants and the kind of people, working class people, who really would profit from having a good, solid progressive there, they don't turn out. They turn out in the presidential race. They don't turn out, apparently, in Democratic primaries. Most of the voters were elderly, and nothing against elderly people voting, but it's interesting. The median age, according to one poll, the age in which half the voters were older than and half were younger than, was 57. That was the average age. So half the voters were older than 57 and half younger. And that tells you that people in their 20s and 30s and even their 40s aren't voting so much.
Absolutely. How much time, guys, did you say? You just whispered in my ear. Sorry, I was listening to... Oh, okay. Would you run again, then?
I might. I might.
Having said all of that, yeah.
I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, no, not in the near future, but absolutely. Look, I'll tell you, the part of it that I loved was, like I said, the part about debating policy. I also loved meeting voters, loved talking to them one-on-one. And you know, I'm a talk radio host, so it shouldn't surprise people that I like to talk. But I would have discussions. I would do things that none of the other politicians did. The other politicians would walk in a room, shake people's hand, and move on. Got to meet more voters. Got to meet more voters. Me, I would have these long, complex discussions of policy that would go into the night. I was always the last candidate to leave every single forum we had, not because I was trying to be, but because voters wanted to talk. And apparently what you try to have to learn as a politician, and I refuse to learn, is how to shut people off, not listen, say, sorry, I don't have time for you, because the trick is getting a lot of votes. And talking an hour with a constituent, well, that, you know, might get you one vote. Better to go out and meet 100 people. And so none of the other politicians would do what I would do, which actually talk to people. And people would come up to me and say, wow, you actually talk to me. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's why I'm running. That's who I am. And they said, you'll never succeed as a politician. And that may well
because you're too nice. Because you're too nice, right?
I don't know.
One last thing before we take a break, quickly.
Yeah.
Do you hate, because I know a part, one of the things, I've been approached to run, we've talked about this. One of the things that keeps me from running, in addition to the fact that my family can't uproot to D.C. right now, maybe later in life. But one of the things I know I won't like, and I'm not sure you do either, because we've talked about this in other areas with regard to businesses we own, right, is raising money. And
I hate raising money.
Do you feel like almost every time you're shaking somebody's hand, you got the other hand out sort of or hoping?
A little bit. I don't know that I raised as much money as I could have, and I don't know that I could have. Most people give money to a candidate who's already in public office because they want something back. And that's sort of implicit bribery is something I've been fighting against in the system all along, so it makes it really hard to win in a system that you're fighting against.
Yep. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about a lot of rulings, federal appeals court rulings, Supreme Court rulings, and we have a lawsuit. And the first day I heard about the lawsuit, I thought, oh, I'm so glad Mark's going to be back Thursday. So we're going to take a break. My co-host is Mark Levine in Washington, D.C. I'm Leslie Marshall in Los Angeles. This is the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show. He joins me every hour two, every Thursday, and tonight, hour three as well. He just ran for Congress in Virginia. He's a great radio talk show host in Washington on local radio. He also does a podcast called The Inside Scoop. And in addition, an attorney, and he's seen on television, spars with a lot of folks. He even spars with me sometimes. We'll be back right after this. Mark Levine is my co-host. I'm Leslie Marshall. This is the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show, every hour two, every Thursday. Mark, it is Throwback Thursday. Did you enjoy that? Bust a move there?
Sure.
Joe likes disco and things like that.
Long time.
Actually, Joe, I hope it's okay that I play with you for a second. Joe is sitting in for Mark Grimaldi tonight. Mark Levine, since you are a gay man, I just want to check this with you. Joe likes the Backstreet Boys and goes to their concerts. He may have to rethink his sexuality, correct?
Am I
correct?
He may be a metrosexual.
Oh, he is. Okay, Joe, you do admit you're a metrosexual, right?
I don't know.
Depends how stylish he is.
Because I don't know what that is. What did you say, Joe? What did you say?
I'm not sure what metrosexual is.
Metrosexual is a straight man who is as stylish as a gay man. So someone who reads GQ magazine, who likes to dress in the latest fashion, who you know really wants to look good going out and spends a lot of time on hair products.
Okay, I guess that's me.
Okay. I love Joe. I love Joe. And I love the fact that Joe is Joe. Do you know what I mean? He makes no apology. He's like, I love the Backstreet, but they're cool. They rock. He's like all excited when he played them the other day. Probably play them tonight now, right?
Oh, they're coming up.
Okay. It's Throwback Thursday, music-wise. But we are not going to talk about throwbacks. We're going to talk about some things that are going on because there's so much going on. And these are in no particular order. Mark, you didn't pick any order tonight, right? Since you didn't give us anything to prep with for you.
But I did. You an email. I sent it to Mark.
I got one topic.
Well,
but I
also mentioned we could talk about ISIS.
I want to talk about a lot of Supreme Court rule. Okay, so you don't mind what I throw at you in any particular order because you know everything.
Anything you.
Okay. Are you still with us?
Sure.
Okay. I heard a click for a second.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, I can hear you. No call waiting a lot. Okay. Without laughing. John Boehner wants to sue the president of the United States. Okay,
oh,
you are
without laughing.
Okay, you're laughing. Okay, the fact that you're laughing and I want to laugh, and I mean, I got to commend Neil Cavuto. Tore a new one in Michelle Bachmann's anus today. Did you see that? I don't know if you saw it, Mark.
I did not see that.
You have got to in the next break. Google it. Neil Cavuto, who is a conservative, tore Michelle Bachmann's a new anus when she said this doesn't go far enough and she wants to impeach. He's shaking his head. No. Okay. Where do I even start? First of all, John Boehner is alleging that the president has overstepped his bounds with 180 some executive orders, yet the predecessor, George W. Bush, had 291. Obama's at the very bottom and within his right as president of the United States via the Constitution to write as many as his heart desires. Is that correct?
Well, and not only that, but a lot of George Bush's executive orders were secret. I mean, literally, he had secret laws.
Correct.
At least the vast majority of President Obama's are open and for people to look at, and of course they're based on the law. Executive order is basically the president filling the holes that Congress left, the interstices of the law. So Congress sets up this broad policy, and it's up to the president to implement it, much like a board of directors says to the CEO, we want you to put this product forward, but the CEO makes decisions about how to put it forward. That's exactly what you want. I mean, you don't have to pick a corporation, you could pick a nonprofit. It's the same thing. The board sets the policy, and then the executive executes. That's what an executive does. That's why they're called executive orders. And as long as they don't conflict with what Congress says, but actually determine how something's done, it's perfectly appropriate for a president to issue an executive order.
So let's talk about this lawsuit. In my mind, there's a midterm election in November, but it doesn't have to do with that, I don't think. I mean, the president's not running. The House is going to be held on to, I believe, by Republicans, the numbers would say. And the Senate race is very tight. I think, and we're going to take a break, so respond after the break, sweetie. I think this is about John Boehner trying to show that he has a set of you-know-what. I think this is John Boehner trying to show that he can be speaker. He can lead. He's going to sue the damn president of the United States, even if it wastes millions of taxpayer dollars and time and screws Republicans, which we'll talk about as well. Mark Levine is my co-host every Thursday, hour two, on the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show. Join us at 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Tweet us. Follow me on Twitter, at Leslie Marshall. And follow Mark. Mark, you're at Mark Levine or at Mark Levine Talk, since I don't have your sheet in front of me. I did know that. At Mark Levine Talk. Follow him there. We'll be back to you right after this. Don't go away. I was just telling Joe off the air, Mark Levine's my co-host. I'm Leslie Marshall. Good evening. Mark Levine is co-hosting Hour 2 on Thursdays and Hour 3 tonight as well. We've missed him. I was telling Joe off the air, when I had to get up as a kid in the morning for school, I think it was high school. It couldn't be middle school. I'm not that old. But yeah, I guess you're all going to think I'm real old now. But it was high school, like my alarm went off and it was the radio. And the local radio station would play that song. They must have had like a loop of songs at certain times or a schedule. And it was almost always what I would wake up to. And I love that song, which is odd because, of course, as a teenager, I didn't love getting up to go to school, especially high school. But, God, I loved that song. Thank you, Joe, for the throwback. Okay, so let's talk from love to laughter, John Boehner and his lawsuit. Now, Mark, we have a call. Can we take that? And then I'd like you to respond just so we don't keep our callers holding too long. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Let's go to Dave in Humboldt County on line 4. Dave, good evening. Apparently, you said you used to work with Mark. Mark Levine, do you know Dave in Humboldt County?
Dave used to be a regular caller to my show, if it's the one I'm thinking of.
I've been a long-time fan of both of you, although I haven't been able to hear you, Mark, for a while. But good to be hearing you now with Leslie Thursdays, huh?
Well, I was running for Congress, Dave, for the last few months.
I would wish you the very best. One of the main issues that I've had, as long as you've known me pretty much, is what kind of faith can we put in our electronic voting? How do we, as a democracy, end up with 99% and 1%, but the 1% somehow manages to get 51% of the elected offices, including the Congress? How does that happen? And I'm a very suspicious man, Mark, and I have been all the time you've known me. How do you feel about electronic voting?
Well, it's a good question. I think there are many reasons why 1% control 51%. First of all, in terms of electronic voting, I agree with you that the only fair way to have a voting system is by paper ballot. And in fact, I pushed my home area in Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, and now we use paper ballots. They're scanned by a machine, but the paper's still there for people to check. And I think that's important because I don't want electronic ballots. I don't want, you know, what used to be Diebold or other electronics basically deciding our election. And I as you know, Dave, I've been on the air 10 years, and Dave was probably on my show for most of those years, at least 5, 6, 7 years ago. The problem was worse than it is now. I mean, it's still a bad problem, but the country is moving toward, solidly toward paper records, and every year you find more and more paper records and less electronic voting. So I think the trend is in the right direction, though we haven't gone far enough. But I actually think the reason why the Republicans are in charge of the House of Representatives is not so much because of electronic voting as it is because of gerrymandering. And I've talked about this before, and so has Leslie, that those who draw the district lines can choose their own voters. And just look at my home state of Virginia. Now, Virginia elected a Democrat to be governor, a Democrat to be lieutenant governor, a Democrat to be attorney general. We have two Democratic senators, and we voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012. So it may be the elections are close in Virginia, but 52 to 54% of the time, the people of Virginia support Democrats. So we are a blue state or a blue-purple state. But because the Republicans continue to control our state house, they draw the district lines. And out of our 11 members of Congress, only 3 are Democrats, 8 are Republicans, even though Republicans are probably only 45 to 48% of the state. So they're a minority in the state, but they control 8 out of 11 seats. I have to do my math quickly. Let's say that's probably 70% or so of the seats. And it's all because what you do is you crowd all the Democrats in these three places. Like I said, my where I live is probably 75% Democrats. And then you give 55% to all the Republicans across the way, and by drawing those district lines, you can take a state that should be split 6-5 for the Democrats and make it 8-3 for the Republicans. And the clearest example we know of this is that in 2012, the majority of Americans voted for a Democratic representative in the House of Representatives. A minority voted for Republican, but the Republicans still control the House. And that's why I think Democrats always should mention they are the majority party. They're the majority party in the Senate. They're the majority party in the House. It's only by tweaking those district lines that the Republicans control the House.
All right, Dave?
Well, it's hard for me to believe that so many people go in and so vote to their own detriment. I can't help but think that there's more to it than that. There's only, I think, one country now in the civilized world that still uses electronic voting, and that is this country. I think Belgium tried it. It was a disaster, and they gave it
up. You know, I agree with you on electronic voting. I also think, though, that there are a number of people who don't vote for their economic interests. You have wealthy liberals, and you have a lot of poor conservatives, people who, because of their religious beliefs or because they've just sort of live in a very conservative mindset, they vote for people who are not at all good for their economic interests. I mean, you look at some poor states in the South that are some of the poorest in the country, and yet they are voting. You could argue it's because of race. There's all kinds of reasons why you might have that. But certainly the 1% or 2% that get rich from Republican policies, they're not enough to vote Republicans in.
All right,
thank
Dave.
Thank you both for all you do.
Oh, thank you very much, Dave.
And thanks for calling, Dave. Good to hear from you.
Absolutely.
Go to my website, marklevinetalk.com, Dave, and you'll see I've been doing a lot of radio, just not so much in the past 4 months.
Good to have you with us, Dave. Good to have you with us. So before the break, my love, I asked you, I said, I think this is about John Boehner. So let's start with that. What is this about? Do you think it's about John Boehner, or do you think this is Republicans are so desperate that this is the length they will go to because they wanted to impeach, but they know they can't impeach and they don't have enough to impeach?
This is a publicity stunt. This is all about John Boehner. John Boehner just saw his deputy, Eric Cantor, lose in Virginia in a primary to the Tea Party. John Boehner does not want to be out Tea Party. He's been fighting the Tea Party his entire speakership. He doesn't know what to do. So he doesn't have a position on the vast majority of policies that are out there. The Republicans don't have a health care plan. They don't have an immigration policy. They don't have a jobs policy. They don't. In fact, when they ask him about his policies, he keeps saying, well, no, we don't have that yet. We have to make sure it's all worked through. We're going to have commissions to study, for example, the people coming to our borders, the children coming to our borders. He has no answers. So when the president puts forward some answers, because you know John Boehner won't compromise, he's got nothing to do. He can't agree with the president. He can't agree to compromise. The Tea Party won't let him do that. He can't propose answers of his own, because that would make his party mad. So he's going to sue the president and hopefully get people not to notice the fact that he can't do anything as Speaker of the House. It's a publicity stunt. And the other thing about it is, given the way things work through the courts, it won't even be ruled on until after President Obama's no longer president. It doesn't make any sense. Plus, it would require an activist judge to basically rule. The vast majority of the time when the executive branch and legislative branch have disagreements, the judiciary stays out of it. They call it a political question. They say, look, the president and Congress disagree. That happens all the time. We're not getting involved. And Republicans usually support that because they don't want judges stepping in with their own policies, and now Boehner, I guess, is backing off that view. It's a really silly thing. It will go nowhere.
Okay. Now let's talk about it, though. You know, in the past, and I think people forget, they did this before. They did this. They said when he pulled his support from the Defense of Marriage Act, and when they did this before, Nancy Pelosi and others, other Democrats, but I think she the loudest, objected. And talk about what the process is for Congress to sue the president. My understanding is, like you said, an individual cannot. It has to be the body of Congress. But the body of Congress, although majority Republican, has Democrats. But it's really not Congress and all the members deciding. It is a bipartisan legal advisory committee, correct?
Well, and not only that, but it's the House of Representatives, because the Senate is controlled by Democrats, and they certainly don't want to sue the president. The vast majority of the time, like I said, the judiciary stays out of fights between the legislative branch and executive branch. The only time the courts get involved is when it really comes down to the mechanics of passing a bill. For example, there's a very famous case called Chadha that's about 30 or 40 years old, where the Congress tried to give a law that allowed only one branch, either House of Representatives or the Senate, to pass a law, and the court said no, Constitution says you need both. Or when they try to do a line item veto, and the court said nope, the Constitution says the president can't do a line item veto. Those kinds of technical procedural issues the court does get involved in. But when it comes to broad questions of policy, how to implement our immigration law, things like that, no, Congress and the president don't fight in the courts. Now, individuals harmed can fight. In other words, if you have been harmed because you've been deported, or you didn't get your refugee status, you could sue because you as an individual are harmed. But Congress and the president rarely go to the court unless it's, like I said, something very technical and procedural.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Because they pulled their support before, why would they risk this? Now, I understand John Boehner, but wouldn't this hurt them? I mean, because right now, the American people, especially those on the right, are into less spending, reduce deficit, create jobs. And the Democrats, if they play their cards right, can really use this to hurt Republicans. So John Boehner, I think, and you tell me if I'm wrong, is taking a huge risk and trying to assert himself and save his ass, showing himself to be, you know, big and puffing out the chest and, you know, doing the Tarzan thing, you know, bounding on it. At the same time, he risks Americans doing what Neil Cavuto did, which is, are you crazy?
Well, the thing to remember is this is entirely political. As I said, even a lawsuit that was proper wouldn't be heard for 3-5 years. President Obama would no longer be president. Speaker Boehner would probably no longer be speaker. So as a lawsuit, it means nothing. Now, as politics, the question is, how does it play, as you say? And there is an argument to be made that it helps, that it hurts Boehner, the one you've made. There's an argument to be made that it helps Boehner because he's looking tough. God knows it's not because of any policies he's put forward. And certainly, defending the Republican establishment against the Tea Party isn't winning him any votes. That's why Eric Cantor got kicked out. So he wants to look tough. Will he look tough? I don't know. I mean, even Neil Cavuto doesn't seem to think so. But remember, it's got nothing to do with the law and everything to do with politics. And politics, at the end of the day, is perception. And that's the question. I can't tell you what the perception will be. In my perception, he looks silly. And, of course, Neil Cavuto is a conservative, and he thinks he looks silly. I don't know. I guess Michelle Bachmann defends him.
We'll take a break. We'll be back. We have other topics to talk about with my co-host, Mark Levine. We hope you'll join us here on the only true democracy in talk radio. Don't go away. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine, my co-host. And Joe is our metrosexual, sitting in for Mark Grimaldi, executive producer. Andrew's rethinking taking this job as one of our new assistant producers. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back. A lot of stuff to talk about. Let's talk about one of the Supreme Court rulings today. I'm originally from Boston, as you know, in the great state of Massachusetts, and that's your neighbor to the north. Abortion seems to remain an issue that divides the Supreme Court. But today, the justices ruled unanimously on something and actually defending the free speech rights of abortion opponents. And I have to say, when I saw this ruling, my jaw dropped. But hear me out for a sec. The court ruled unanimously that Massachusetts went too far, literally, because it created a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics to keep demonstrators away from patients. Okay, I'm pro-choice, as you know. I personally, entering a medical building where they performed abortions and did many other women's services when I lived in Buffalo, New York, was pushed by a woman that said, "Don't abort your baby." And I turned around, I'm like, and I fell on the ice because very slippery, very icy during the winter in Buffalo, New York, years ago. I actually was going because I had what's called a positive pap smear, and they needed to do this freezing thing on me. And it had nothing to do with pregnancy, as I was not pregnant. And she, you know, pushed me down, and I looked at her. I said, "I'm not pregnant, but if I had been, you might have killed my baby." You know, I have to say, I'm torn on this one, because although I can't stand the tactics of many of these abortion opponents, if they are within the First Amendment, which is to peacefully demonstrate and protest, they are within their right. But yet, there, I believe, should have some woman's right to privacy and protection. I mean, there was FACE, freedom to access the clinic entrance, that was passed in the past. So I wanted your take, because I know you and I are both pro-choice, and we both care about free speech, but we also care about privacy and safety. Were you surprised that the ruling was unanimous? Are you not surprised, and do you agree with them?
I have not read the ruling yet. I know about the ruling, but I haven't read the text of it. I'd be curious to know why the liberal justices voted for it as well. But I think we need to take it out of the abortion context and deal with it as a pure free speech question. And I'm someone who's been, I've tried to lay out my own free speech rules here and try to figure out where it's appropriate, where it's not, because I myself have tried to protest. And in fact, in San Diego in 1996, I tried to protest the Republican National Convention. I did nothing other than have my sign with Clinton Gore, and I said 4 more years, and I said so with an earshot of the Republican members walking in, and the police tried to move me a mile and a half away to a very hot school playground surrounded by barbed wire where no one could hear me, and I argued I had a right to be within earshot. So I've been on that side of it. On the other hand, I know when some of the awful, and to call them homophobes really doesn't do it justice to their hate. The Westboro Baptist Church was trying to go to funerals at Arlington National Cemetery and somehow blame the people who died in Iraq on gay rights, which it doesn't even make sense. But you know, here are parents who've lost their son or daughter, in their 20s, and are grieving and have to deal with this awful hate, I was actually sympathetic to the idea that that they had to keep a distance from funerals. So here's how I look at this, and it's actually a fascinating legal question. I love free speech questions. So the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech, but that's that's not at all how it's been interpreted. It's been interpreted that you are allowed to set up time, place, and manner restrictions. And all throughout the law, you will find time, place, and manner restrictions. In other words, you can say that no one can protest in this park, or everyone can protest in this park, and you can do so with placards that are a certain size, or only in these hours, you know, not overnight, where it could wake the neighbors, and you have to do so peacefully. But what you can't say is Republicans in the park, Democrats not, or Democrats in the park, Republicans not, or pro-choice in, pro-life out. You can't ever make a distinguishing feature on the basis of what kind of speech it is. In other words, what the person speaking supports or not. But you can always set up time, place, and manner restrictions. And it was my belief that, for example, with regard to the funerals, that a funeral is a private affair. And, you do not have to invite people in your home. If someone comes to my door and wants to convert me to a religion, I can say thank you, but no thank you, and close the door in their face, and I don't have to invite them in my home. It's my home. Now, I do have to allow them in a public space. If they can approach me on the sidewalk, they just can't approach me in my home. So the heart of the question is whether or not these things are private or public. I actually think a funeral is a private enough gathering that you could restrict speakers there. In a doctor's clinic, which is not owned by any government, I think there's an argument to be made that that's private too. Now, they can be on the sidewalks, the public sidewalks, you know, as you go to the abortion clinic. I think they have a clear right to do that. And so I don't know about 35 feet. We can argue about how much feet is available.
Because it's really not the footage as opposed to me, where are they standing? I mean, they can't block the entrance.
Right.
But if they're standing, like when you open the door, and when the door is fully open, if they're standing right there as you're walking in, it again depends on the person. There's a woman that they talked about today on TV who's an older woman who gets down on her knees, and she prays for the women as they go in, and she does not approach them. And she said if they want to come to her and talk to her, she'll gladly talk to them. But all she does is pray for them. Interesting, and very interesting to me that it was a unanimous ruling. We will be back with Hour 3. Mark Levine is my co-host, and he'll be sticking around for that hour as well. I hope you will, too. You want to join us, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Follow Mark on Twitter. Tweet him there, at Mark Levine Talk. Follow me, at Leslie Marshall. Tonight, my co-host, partner in crime, he's on the East Coast, Washington, D.C. I'm on the West in Los Angeles. He is Mark Levine, attorney, talk show host, and just ran for Congress in Virginia. And I, well, you know me. Our show in this hour, we are going to be talking with each other, but we're going to be talking with you as well. We've been talking about Supreme Court rulings. We talked about, if you want to touch upon it, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. The lawsuit that John Boehner is putting forth, how that will bode for him and for Republicans, what you think of it, will it be successful? We talked about that. We touched upon the unanimous Supreme Court ruling with regard to clinics and to abortion opponents protesting at those clinics, talking a little bit more in this hour about that with you, and then to some other Supreme Court rulings, another court ruling, and just a whole bunch of other stuff. Mark, welcome back, and everybody welcome back listening. Thanks for being with me again in this hour, buddy. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. I wanted also to talk about the ruling that came down Wednesday, the first federal court.
No, we're going to talk about it. We're going to get to it.
We're going
to
get there. All right. Just want to make sure you didn't miss it. All right.
No, I didn't miss it. There's a method to my madness.
Okay.
okay, talking about the Supreme Court striking down the abortion clinic buffer zone, Massachusetts may not get their 35 feet, but Massachusetts could put, or the clinic could put, armed police officers outside to make sure. And I say that because there are people that are not peaceful, and there are people that try and touch. It's like, do not touch me when I'm trying to walk into a building. You know what I mean? Peacefully and talk to me about that very briefly. As an attorney and somebody who knows the Constitution inside out, upside down and sideways, Mark, that First Amendment, does that cover you if you grab me or push me or no, that is possible?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
When I say that, because that does happen, you know, that does happen at these clinics. This is a very emotionally charged topic.
It does. And the court said if it happens, then people need to call the police, and then the police have to come, and then they have to tell that person to disperse. And then after they tell them to disperse, if they don't disperse, they can arrest them, which is a pretty cumbersome process. But I would actually tell everyone going to an abortion clinic in the country to be ready to call 911. And the moment somebody touches you, immediately call 911. And maybe if we get lots and lots of 911 calls, the police will come out, and it may be the best way to stop this. I don't know. It's a shame to tax the 911 system with it, but apparently, according to the United States Supreme Court, that's the only recourse you have is to call the police.
So you don't agree with the ruling, you do agree with the ruling, and were you surprised by it being unanimous?
Well, okay, so I do agree that anyone has a right to be on public walks and sidewalks. And I also think people have the right to be within seeing and hearing distance. People have a right to express. This is, you know, what I was trying to do at the Republican National Convention. In fact, I was very upset by a free speech ruling back in George Bush's era, where people who were greeting the president in a public space, it was a sidewalk outside an airport, the Secret Service went by and looked at the T-shirts of people, and one person had a T-shirt that was against the Iraq War, and they basically kicked him out, and they said that anyone who disagrees with the president has no right to criticize the president in a public space. The Supreme Court upheld that. They said that, well, anyone who has a T-shirt criticizing the president could be seen as a safety hazard for the president, which I thought was a really, really stupid, dangerous ruling. But in general, I do think that any kind of protester has a right to be on a public sidewalk within seeing and hearing distance. I don't think you have the right to be within touching distance. I think that's too much to ask. And I also think that given there's a history of people, touching, and, you know, we've seen all those police barriers before. We've seen protesters. They have the yellow tape, and they put them on one side, and you're not allowed to cross the line. I think that should be the distinction. Whether it's 35 feet or 10 feet, clearly you don't have the right to touch someone, but you do have the right to shout at someone, and that's where I would make the distinction. And the other thing I would also ask is whether any of these abortion facilities, to the extent that they're private, I think you have a right to ban any kind of speech in a private place.
Yes, most definitely agree with you there. So let's talk about some of the other rulings, shall we?
Sure.
Again, I was just very surprised because they were very conservative-leaning rulings today, even by the liberals on the court. Let's talk about the Supreme Court ruling against the president's recess appointments. If you can explain this, because the Supreme Court, well, let's take a call first and then we'll go to that. Let's go to Michael in Long Island, line 4. Michael, good evening. Thank you for joining us. Question or comment regarding this ruling, and I think you were calling about the free speech ruling with regard to those protesting around abortion clinics.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Leslie. Good evening, Mark, and good evening.
Good evening.
Listen, I think let's set the context here, right, which is obviously if a woman chooses to get an abortion, she has the legal right to do so. What often ends up happening are there's two outcomes. We have people who are respectful objectors to abortion who go there hoping to convince someone who's going to receive one that there are alternatives. Some people go and pray. Some people are respectful. Some people are reasonable objections. There are another group of people, though, who can bump, as you have stated. Some people try and block these facilities and don't permit people in, and therein lies the extremes. So I think that with the court's decision today is coupled with what Mark had to say, which is, you know, people should not bump into them, people should not be trying to block them. People have the right to free speech, but it is limited. Now, to the one point I would disagree with, just ever so respectfully with Mark, is that while it is a private facility, all taxpayers are contributing to and funding taxpayer-funded abortions. And so, to some extent, these people have a legitimate right to, if they believe in their hearts, if they believe personally, as I do, I'm pro-life, but I don't believe in imposing my will upon other people. Live your own life. Live your own life by the things you believe in, but I can understand this decision. It's a
well, I don't know we're that far apart, Michael. I would like to see a new law developed by Massachusetts that says that any clinic that has a history of people blocking access can set up yellow police tape and can set it up, let's say, not 35 feet. Let's say 10 feet away from the pathway, because you can't reach across 10 feet. If people start throwing things, then we'll call the police. But so within 10 feet, you can be seen or heard, but you can't be touched. And I think that's, and I don't think you should have to have the police there. I think you could just set up the police tape. And it's all about separating people, but allowing for freedom of speech. On the private-public distinction, I don't think you want to argue that everything that's taxpayer-funded immediately becomes public. We have a lot of taxpayer-funded private corporations that I don't think would agree that it suddenly becomes public. So I don't think that's the issue. But I do think reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. And if I were on the court, I would say you have a right to be seen and heard as a protester. But the person that's being protested certainly has a right not to be touched. And so I think maybe 10 feet, not 35 feet, but something like that, where you set up the tape ahead of time, everyone knows it's going to be a protest, and the people keep their distance. I think that's a way to do it.
Okay. And anything else, Michael?
No, I would just say I don't think we're that far apart.
I don't think we are either.
I think
we largely agree. And the nice thing about these issues,
right. Most importantly, as Americans, we should all believe that we're entitled to our freedom of speech, but it should always be respectful, and it should always be to the extent that we are using our intelligence to try and persuade people, but never trying to impose our will upon other people. Everyone has the right to do as they see fit. That's the greatest thing about our country.
I agree with you, and I'd actually go further and say that there's no First Amendment requirement that you be respectful. I appreciate when people are respectful. I think it's the best way to persuade someone, but I would argue in the First Amendment you could even be obnoxious as long as you don't touch someone, which you have an absolute right not to be touched. So even the awful Westboro people have a right to exist. The nice thing about free speech cases is that, you know, wherever you are, liberal or conservative, most of us have been on all sides of that. We've been the protester, and we've been the protested, and I just think these clear lines make for good neighbors.
All right. Thank you. Michael, anything else?
The only other thing I would say is, you know, that the decisions today by the Supreme Court were very interesting and obviously very worthy of discussing this evening on your show. The only other thing I would say is, listen, as a conservative Republican, a right-to-life Republican, no less, you know, I can recall just 5 or 6 years ago when President Obama was then candidate, U.S. Senator from Illinois, and he was often marketed in the mainstream media. One of the traits that we were told about was that he was this marvelous scholar of the U.S. Constitution, and yet his administration suffered its 13th defeat in the United States Supreme Court since 2012 today. That's just stunning. I mean,
Michael, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't consider the Massachusetts case anything to do really with the president. Do you, Mark?
No, it's not a federal case at all. It's a Massachusetts state law.
Yeah. So I don't agree with your number 13. But okay, Michael, thank you. I appreciate your call tonight, Mark, and I appreciate that. Mark, let's talk about defeat, definitely, for the president and for his administration with regard to the Supreme Court and his recess appointment. So the people understand what the president did, why this reached the Supreme Court, how they ruled and what that means. Because some people were like, well, does that mean these people lose their jobs? Does he have to reappoint them? What does this mean going forward? Does he get a slap on the hand? What does the ruling mean, or is it just symbolic?
Well, this is actually a really complex issue. I'll try to give you the upshot first, which is that because the Democratic Senate gave up abandoned filibusters and made them not proper for presidential appointments, every single person on the National Labor Relations Board, either they've been reappointed or a Democrat has been appointed to fill their seats. So what they're going to do now is the NLRB are going to go back and they're going to reaffirm all these things things that the prior ones did, so it really won't affect anyone's case. But the general rule, I think, was a reasonable one. Again, remember, both this and the abortion decision, what happened was you had Chief Justice Roberts join with the four liberals to come up with a middle-of-the-road position, and then you had the four conservatives agree with the decision, but angrily suggest they should have gone much further. And that's why you find these were unanimous decisions, but they weren't. They were 5-4 opinions, and I actually think they came to a reasonable discussion. Remember, Democrats prevented President Bush from doing pro forma appointments, recess appointments, by keeping these pro forma sessions every 3 days in the Senate. So what they basically said is if it's under 10 days of a recess, that doesn't count. That's not enough of a recess to do an appointment. If it's more than 10 days, then it is. And I kind of like that. It's a bright line rule. No one had said before whether 3 days seemed too short, but 30 days seemed too long, and they said, okay, 10. Well, that seems actually a reasonable thing for presidents to use in the future. Presidents have always done recess appointments. They're allowed by the Constitution, but it had never been settled what exactly a recess was. The conservatives wanted to argue that the only recess that existed was in between Congresses. In other words, for 2 years, there could be no recess, and basically the conservatives would say that every president from George Washington to Barack Obama broke the Constitution by doing recess appointments. And four justices wanted to say that, but Chief Justice Robert ruled with the liberals that said that was going too far to declare all presidents from George Washington on to have broken the law, and came up with this reasonable solution of 10 days, which actually makes sense to me.
Okay. People understand, will these be, you know, the same appointments because it's not in a recess? And what does that mean going forward? The president just can't or won't do that in the future because of this ruling.
Right. It was an unsettled part of the law. It wasn't clear how many days constitutes a recess. I do like bright line rules as a lawyer. I think 10 days is a fair middle point. And what happened is now that the Senate Democrats rightly got rid of the filibuster on presidential appointees, it really won't matter. It will matter when the Senate is controlled by the opposition party, then the issue will come up again.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have other issues that we'll be talking about tonight. Mark Levine and I are co-hosting the show. I'm Leslie Marshall. I hope you'll join us. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543 is the number. Love the Go-Go's! Throwback Thursday. And it's also Mark Levine and Leslie Marshall, Inside Scoop Edition of the Leslie Marshall Show on Thursday. Normally, Mark's with me every Thursday, hour two. But tonight, I am blessed with his presence for 2 hours, hours two. And three. Guys, tell me again in my ear how much time we have in this segment, because we got a... Huh? Okay. Oh, boy. We have so
much. Not much.
Just a few minutes. So we're not going to get into the two biggies that we'll talk about on the other side of this hour. Let me ask you something that you probably are aware of that I just heard about yesterday. The Supreme Court, correct me if I'm wrong, is going to be looking at whether or not somebody can threaten to kill somebody, since people are doing it so regularly on Facebook and Twitter. Is that true? And what do you think the outcome of that will be?
Well, you have no right to threaten to kill somebody. That's one of the limits of free speech. There are always limits of free speech. It's not just time, place, and manner restrictions for protesters. You don't have the right to libel someone, to slander someone, to make up a lie about someone that harms them. You don't have the right to threaten someone. People a lot of times don't know what assault and battery means. They think an assault is when you attack someone. Actually, that's not true. Legally, a battery is when you attack someone. An assault is when you threaten to attack someone. So someone who's convicted of assault and battery basically said, I'm going to get you, and then got them. So yes, you cannot threaten to kill someone. Actually, this is an easy legal case, and it's legally actionable. Now, you can argue it was a joke, and, you know, obviously people say, I'm going to kill you, and they don't mean it, and that you're allowed to do. But if it was a serious threat meant to be taken seriously.
Well, that's what it is. It's a man who said he wanted to kill his wife, and I guess he did it on social media, and he didn't do it, and, I don't understand how it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. But I guess that's the issue, is that there are people out there.
It's a factual question. Did he did he mean, you know, I want to kill my wife and come help me kill my wife? Or did he mean, my wife makes me so mad, I just want to kill her sometimes, you know? And obviously, one is a serious threat and the other is a joke. And it would be up to a jury to decide that difference. But I think that's a factual question, not a legal question.
Well, it is going to be decided by the Supreme Court. That's what I heard on the news yesterday.
I'll check it out during the break and find out why, because I don't understand the issue, frankly. To me, that's a clear line in the law. That's very clear. You can joke, but you can't threaten. So I'll take a look. I don't understand why it's before the Supreme Court.
Me either. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about something not before the Supreme Court, but a court. And we're going to talk about something taking place overseas. Iraq is a four-letter word, but so is ISIS. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. He's in D.C. I'm in L.A. Where are you? Join us tonight, 8886-LESLIE. 888-653-7543 is the number. Follow Mark on Twitter, at Mark Levine Talk. Follow me on Twitter, at Leslie Marshall. We'll be back. And we're back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. Mark, let's take a couple of calls before we get to some other issues that are going on. And let's go to David in Massachusetts, line 5. David, good evening. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Leslie. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? I understand that you have a story that you wanted to share about the abortion topic in this ruling.
Yeah, when I was 17 years old, my mom found out that I was actually about to fund an abortion for a friend of mine who was in an unwanted pregnancy. And as punishment, she took me to an abortion protest. And she let me sit in the car, but from the car, I saw her, and she was very peaceful. She mostly just was born again Christian, just wanted to pray for people and counsel the girls going in. She's very soft-spoken, very sweet lady. And one of the women, one of the girls that she approached, kind of bumped against her and basically recoiled. And I was wondering what was going on. I was wondering, okay, why is this girl assaulting my mom? And I got out of the car and ran up. And lo and behold, I find out that the girl was basically trying to act like my mom hit her. So, you know, while I appreciate the point of, you know, that you can't have assaults, unfortunately, people tend to be like a flopper on the World Cup, and they, you know, tend to act like they've been hit when they really haven't. So it makes it kind of a dicey situation there. I mean, you know,
I think there's an easy solution.
Go ahead. Mark wanted to jump in. He said he thinks there's an easy solution.
I think there's an easy solution. That's what I suggested before. The police should just keep them separated. No one should be allowed to touch anybody. That's why you need at least 10 feet. You put up yellow police tape, and you say the protesters cannot get within touching distance.
Let me ask you, with freedom, with the face law, the entrance, is the entrance just the door, or is there a certain amount into the sidewalk that legally an establishment has as their own? I can't imagine the sidewalk right up to the door is public property, or is it?
I don't know whether whether there's some property between the sidewalk, and obviously if there's a path from the sidewalk to the clinic, that's private property. Sidewalk is a public sidewalk, that's true. But even then, I think if there's a history here, I think the police can keep people from bumping into each other. I think they have that right as part of a time, place, and manner restriction, even in a public place. That's why you find that when there are protesters on any subject, the police will often divide them up and say, all right, you who are support this cause, you get on this side of the street. You who are against it, do be on the other side of the street. It doesn't matter which side of the street they're on. The police are separating people who might be antagonists. And in this case, I think separating people is the right idea. And to the extent that that's all that Massachusetts was trying to decide to do, I support Massachusetts. Now, you know, whether it's 35 feet or 10 feet to me isn't that big a deal. But let's keep people separated when they're this emotional subject.
Okay.
That's my answer.
David?
Yeah, hi. I just think that still infringes on free speech, because you can't really talk to somebody from 10 feet away. And like,
but they can approach you.
My mother, I mean, she's just a peace-loving person and just wanted to personally engage people. But if they really didn't want to talk to her, then she was not pushy. And I don't think
all
that
she has to say. Yeah, but I don't think that your mother is the I think your mother is, in some areas, the exception, not the rule. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think that people should be given a fair shot, and people that are proved to be too aggressive, then they should be barred, maybe. Maybe you could make the law that way, where people with...
Yeah, but then who's going to pay for the police? Are you going to ask the abortion protesters to pay for the police or the state to pay for them? If you just stay 10 feet away, then reasonable people like your mom say, come here, I want to talk with you. I want to persuade you that this is a wrong thing to do. 10 feet is not that far away. You can definitely hear someone 10 feet away. And if the women don't want to talk to your mother, they have a right not to talk with them and to go into the abortion clinic. But 10 feet is not very far. And I think that it's non-touching distance, and that's what matters. Maybe it should be 6 feet, but, you know, it's non-touching distance.
All right. David, thank you. Appreciate the call, and appreciate you sharing your story and your comment tonight. Thank you. Let's go to Reggie in Georgia, line 4. Reggie, your comment.
How you doing, Leslie?
Good.
How you doing, Mark?
Hey, Reggie.
How you doing, Mark Levine?
I'm good, Reggie. How are you?
Just fine. Well, I would just like to reinstate that what I told Leslie Marshall about this laughable lawsuit last night. If we let this happen, and if they can go after Barack Obama, who's next? You know, how are we going to put a stop to it before it starts? And I'm afraid this might set a precedent if anybody lets this go through or falls through. You know what I'm saying?
It's not. It's meaningless. It means nothing.
It's not going to happen, right?
The court is, well, anyone can file suit. I mean, anyone can file a lawsuit, but the lawsuit will go nowhere, and therefore I'm not worried about it. And the reason why even the conservatives on the Supreme Court won't allow this lawsuit is precisely because of what you say, Reggie. They don't want some liberal Congress to challenge a conservative president under this. So lawsuits are only for procedural things, like the recess appointment, okay? That's a fair procedural question, but not the general conduct of the presidency. That's just silly.
Right. And I wish somebody would tell that to him, you know?
He knows it's silly. He's doing it for political reasons. He knows it's going nowhere. John Boehner's smart enough to know that his lawsuit's a joke.
Right. But he's just saying it or doing it to cover his ass. And to show that he's
pretty much.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And then
yep.
He's tough and powerful and big and bold and courageous, you know?
Yep.
He's trying to, you know, he's trying to keep his seat, I guess.
Yep. That's it. That's it. This is all about him.
Right.
And I'm kind of hoping it hurts the Republican Party because it's such a ridiculously politically motivated, selfish act. Reggie, thank you for the call, buddy. Always good to hear from you. Mark, let's talk about a ruling in Utah, and let's tell the great folks listening tonight about this. Speaking of courts, we have in a federal appeals court yesterday, for the first time, employed a landmark Supreme Court decision to declare that fundamental right to marriage must be extended to gay couples, and that adds momentum to a remarkably rapid recognition of same-sex marriage by judges nationwide. First of all, tell everybody listening about what happened in Utah and then what that means or could mean on a national level, because, you know, state after state, it's almost daily now, these bans are considered unconstitutional, which they clearly are. This is discriminatory.
It is occurring at an amazingly rapid rate. And what's more amazing is that every single case on the issue has found that it is unconstitutional to deny the right of gay and lesbian people to marry. It's unconstitutional. Now, this is something where almost every day we hear of a new state. I mean, it used to be big news. You know, Massachusetts was the first, 2004, and then, you know, Connecticut was the second, and that was years later. Now it's virtually every month. I mean, Pennsylvania and Oregon were a month ago. Yesterday was Indiana. There are now 20 states and the District of Columbia that have marriage equality, and there's another 13 states, including conservative states like Utah, like Oklahoma, like Texas, where the lower court judge has found that any denial of equal rights to gay people to marry or lesbian people to marry is unconstitutional. And so this is already in two-thirds of the states now, 33 out of 50. All of this will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is the first federal court of appeals. This is the next level, right? There's the lower court, the district court that occurs in an area of a state or the entire state. This is a very conservative court of appeals. It's the 10th court of appeals. It states like Utah and Oklahoma and Wyoming and Colorado. New Mexico is the only state that's arguably a little bit liberal. And yet they found that this was unconstitutional, and every single state from Texas to Oklahoma to Utah, not to mention states like Michigan and more liberal states, Wisconsin, has found it unconstitutional. What I think this means is that June 2015, it will go before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they will come down to a ruling 1 year from today, mark my words, they will find by a 5-4 decision, maybe 6-3, but probably 5-4, that there's full marriage equality across the nation, and this something that frankly, I played a personal role in beginning in the 1990s when even the gay and lesbian community thought it was impossible. And when I began the first marriage equality protest in the country, the first Valentine's Day protest in the country, now it looks like a mere 15 years later, I thought it would take 25 years, frankly, but a mere 15 years later, we've gone from something that was considered impossible even by the gay and lesbian establishment to something that is readily accepted by the majority of Americans and already by the way, with Indiana included, 45% of Americans already live in a state that has marriage equality. So we're just about at the half-half point population-wise. We have reached the tipping point, and it's really exciting. In fact, it's exciting how humdrum it's becoming. It used to be huge news when a state had marriage equality, and now it's like every month, oh, there goes Pennsylvania, oh, there goes Oregon, oh, there goes Indiana, oh, there's Illinois. And suddenly, these huge, important states, and it's just sort of local news to those states. That's about it.
All right, let's take another caller, and we go to Paul in Woodinville, Washington, line 4. Paul, good evening. Thank you for joining us.
No, hi, Leslie. Can I say something about John Boehner's, before I get into the marriage equality case? John Boehner is a chain-smoking, alcoholic, drunken fool. And he's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. This case, it strikes me to ask, what kind of lawsuit is this? I mean, where is he planning to file this lawsuit? In federal district court, a trial court? That means you have to present evidence that some federal law has been violated, or federal laws, by the President of the United States. Okay, then what remedy would this district court have for this for this thing? Well, or you could say, no, he's going to go the constitutional route and take it to the Supreme Court and say, basically, dereliction of duty. And the Supreme Court, even this band of jackals, would tell him, look, you have a constitutional provision. It's called impeachment.
That's right. That is the way. Exactly. If Congress doesn't like what the president is doing, they can impeach him. That's what the House of Representatives has a right to do under the Constitution. He would probably go to a federal district court in the District of Columbia, present whatever evidence he wants, but you're right. Every lawsuit you file, you have to say what your remedy is. What's his remedy? Does he want the court to enjoin the president of the United States, issue an injunction saying, Mr. President, don't do this, and if you do, we'll hold you in contempt, which means we're going to jail the president or fine him? You know, the only time we've ever seen that is, you know, where Richard Nixon didn't turn over the tapes, or, you know, where Bill Clinton, the court found him in contempt, but that was only not in his presidential capacity. That was basically as a lawyer for the in the Monica Lewinsky, Paula Jones case. But it's unthinkable to challenge the president in his official capacity and to ask the court to hold him in contempt. You're right. Impeachment is the remedy, period.
There's no constitute, because he's got the cart before the horse here, because first you impeach him, remove him from office, then if as a private citizen you would try him in federal court for the violation of the law. That's the way the process is supposed to work. But again, he needs to have another pack of cigarettes and a couple more glasses of Merlot. On to the marriage equality. So this is the 10th Circuit Court struck down the Utah ban. So we have it's close to 10 federal district court cases that have struck down bans on marriage equality. Now we're up to the next level of this circuit court, appeals, and there's another one pending in the 6th District.
It's all across the country. There are 20 states with marriage equality. There's another 13 where the laws have been struck down, but they're being stayed based waiting on this Supreme Court case that I said would be heard, I think, next year. And that's two-thirds of the states. That only leaves 17 states unaffected, mostly in the South and in very red states. But they're coming, because once it's in Utah, once it's in Oklahoma, once it's in Texas, you know, it's throughout a lot of red states.
Right, but am I correct that the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Ohio area is still pending the federal judge in Michigan that struck down the Michigan ban? That's still pending, so that's got to come up again, right?
Well, that's pending, but it's pending in virtually every court of appeals, what I'm saying. You're right,
okay.
It's pending in the Sixth. It's pending virtually everywhere. But the only place it's not pending is the First Circuit, because all those states already have marriage equality in New England. But
right.
In virtually every state, in fact, in every single state that has denied gay and lesbian couples the right to marry, it has been challenged. And it's either up before the district court or the appellate court, depending on which state it is.
All right. Thank you. Anything else, Paul?
Yeah, I just
hang on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll let you finish. Does that sound good? We got to take a break. I'm a little late on breaking here. We'll be back with Paul, our caller, Mark Levine, my co-host. I'm Leslie Marshall, talking about this ruling in Utah, other Supreme Court rulings, lawsuit by Boehner, and so much more. We may even fit in a little bit of Iraq and ISIS coming up. Don't go away.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out.
We are back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He is Mark Levine, and our caller is Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Gentlemen, thank you for holding. Welcome back. Paul, go ahead. Wrap it up. Another comment. You had a last comment for us.
Yeah, thanks. I agree with Mark that a year from now, we are going to have marriage equality will be the law of the land. Although I'm going to make this prediction that it's going to be the decision is going to be 8-1, I think. And the reason I
no
that,
way,
no way.
You have too much faith in Scalia and Thomas and Alito.
No! I didn't say. Oh no! Antonin Scalia predicted this, so he's got a virtually literally unanimous federal court decisions. And actually, what he predicted, I think Samuel Alito is not an idiot. He can see that this is unconstitutional. And John Roberts has a big motivation to try and develop consensus on this court, so he doesn't look like a complete incompetent Chief Justice. The holdout will be Clarence Thomas.
Call a year from now. I agree that Kennedy will be on board, and Justice Roberts may be. That's why I said 5-4 or 6-3. I do not think Alito, Scalia, or Thomas will be on board.
Fair enough.
And then at that point, we will hear about massive hangings and wrist slitting by the extreme staunch homophobic community, correct?
Well, that'll be good news, won't it?
I'm not going to be that mean. Everybody's got a mommy, you know? All right, Paul, thank you. Thank you for calling us tonight. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Mark, let's lastly talk about Iraq, ISIS, the president getting blamed, and maybe the president being much smarter than everyone thought, waiting. Now that we hear more and more coming out that this is not just ISIS, and this maybe is not something we should be involved in. And by the way, if we had never invaded the sovereign nation of Iraq, we wouldn't be having this conversation anyway.
Well, on that latter point, I 100% agree. There was no Al-Qaeda, there was no ISIS in Iraq, and we took a stable, if awful, situation and turned it into an unstable and more awful situation. But we are where we are now. And basically the reason why the Sunnis are uprising is because Maliki, the prime minister, is a Shia, and he's basically not looking out for their interests. So they're looking the other way and even supporting these awful people. I think this is just turning into a really ugly civil war. I hope that the Kurds get out of it, and they are, frankly, very stable and democratic, and they can be independent up there. But Shia and Sunni war, it's really ugly. And either Iraq has to look out for all of its population, or we're just going to end up with two states, or three, including the Kurds. And I don't think that's such a terrible thing. Sometimes I think that the good fences make good neighbors. Maybe we need a three-state solution in Iraq, but we'll see.
Okay. And last but not least, anything we didn't cover tonight that you'd like to talk about? Oh, but by the way, no. What would you advise the president do with regard to Iraq? If he said,
"Mark, what do you think?" It's such a hard question. I think we have to pressure Iraq to do things that make it look out for all of its people, not just the Shia, but the Sunni as well. It's tough because it's a majority Shia nation. Basically, any democracy, the only democracies that work on this planet are those that have majority rule with minority rights. And you can go too far in one direction. I think Maliki went too far in terms of majority rule and didn't have minority rights, and that's why they're facing civil war right now. Everyone has to have the right to practice their religion, to have an equal share in government, to have an equal chance. That's what we're talking about, whether it's gay and lesbian couples in the United States or whether it's Shia, Sunni, and Kurd in Iraq. The reason why America succeeds is precisely because we have a First Amendment that allows all religions to be practiced. That's why we don't have religious wars between us. That's why it's such a good idea. Freedom of religion is basic, and you've got to give every single group in Iraq a chance to succeed. And now you've got this horrible terrorist group. I probably would support helping Maliki in some way fight back ISIS because it's so terrible. And yet, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. It's there's no easy answers here, and I won't pretend to have any.
All right, Mark, oh, you are awesome. Mark, quickly give a website. I know, follow you on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. Website?
MarkLevineTalk.com. Facebook as well.
And I'm out of town next week on Thursday. I don't know if we're running a best of. You're filling in for me, but I know we'll be back together soon. And proud of you, buddy. Sorry you lost. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. Have a great night. Thank you to Joe and to Andrew, my great crew.